predictions. But hell, parallel becomes, it has been, two apocalyptic warnings. So that, you might say, the market, or the rise in the market for apocalyptic warnings is more rapid than the accumulation of credit through correct prediction. It's like Kurzweil was the big name, and he was saying completely implausible things that turned out to be true, and Eliezer was this weirdo, and now Eliezer is the big name. And we don't hear much about Kurzweil, even though in the past his predictions have been just incredibly vindicated.
How do you argue that? Tell me how you argue that his predictions have been vindicated.
Kurzweil?
No. Why?
No, I did. I said okay. Kurzweil's predictions were analytically ridiculous seeming, but have been vindicated by Pan.
I'm with
past.
You on that.
And Eliezer's market stock has risen much faster without a similar set of vindicated predictions.
Okay. Why do you think that is?
I was speculating that the market, that the beta on doomerism is greater than the alpha on correct prediction.
I see.
Oh, it's a citizen bond.
I see. What has the community as a whole thought?
If anybody was thinking, we wouldn't be writing a book about like this. You asked what the community thought, but if anyone thought, no one would build it, and no one would need to be told that they would not die if they don't. Like, the community isn't thinking. Nobody is thinking. Like, they're not even carrying out, like, plausible collages of thinking anymore, people in general. They're doing something like a purely kabuki theaterized version that, like, I'm paying a lot of attention to stablecoins because, you know, it's just like Bitcoin with all of the downsides, but without the possibility of making a lot of money. It's totally going to be the next big thing, you know?
Why has the community stopped thinking in your mind?
Thank you.
That's yours, Mike.
Sure. They got respectable, it turned out everything wasn't respectable.
How many people are on vacation?
So, like, yeah, I mean, the news of a whole like that is not news about the content of the book. It's just news about the fact that the book is advertised on the side of a highway in San Francisco.
Right, yeah, I did see that. When I came back, it was terrible.
The medium is 100% of the message.
Right. Do you get a sense of whether or not the general public is responding? Do they get it? Do they not?
So, the reason the book was written was because Eliezer and I found pretty clearly that the general public did respond much more reasonably to these sorts of arguments than the more educated and elite. You know, that the cab drivers and people in stores had a strong intuition that we shouldn't want to make ourselves extinct, while elites tend to be like, well, really, isn't that just the nature of things and the cycle of life? And that sort of thing is a more final say than I'm not convinced this is going to happen, you know?
But you had a good idea to get together and chat a lot of this, talk a lot of this through.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, we should be using chatbots, definitely. That's like.
Yeah, Michael, do you want.
Sure, I'll just.
I have my own recording.
Yeah, it's fine. I don't think it'll stop my recording if I'm making a chatbot, but I will take out a chatbot. I'll take them all out, in fact. Any preferences between Claude's 4.1 versus 4.5?
4.5 is pretty good.
How about Deep Sea?
Okay. Deep Sea.
I'm joking. Oh. Use whatever you want.
I normally use a bunch in parallel But Gemini loses its chain of thought much more often than the others when you do it in parallel. Like, you kind of need to keep the app open, or you don't get responses.
And what are we doing with the Gemini?
I mean, in general, I guess the main thing to do is to help it work through where information isn't flowing. Because most of the time, information doesn't seem to flow in ways that it naively seems it would.
What role is it playing here?
So the bots can very clearly spell out what the obvious implications of things are. One way of thinking about this is contemporary politeness is more or less the opposite of active listening. People maintain plausible deniability by responding in ways that do not nail down that they have compiled propositions. And the...
Kate, you do this all the time.
Yes, absolutely all the time.
Specifically, I'm talking about the thing where you say, I get it, I'm with you, when, like, the immediate previous context makes it pretty clear that you didn't actually get it.
Well, when I say I get it, what I mean is I understand your stance. It doesn't mean that
you say that you understand his stance when you make it extremely clear that you are saying things precisely so as to not be potentially held accountable for having understood his stance. That this is this is the sort of thing that's worth talking about. Okay, let's. I mean, I guess we can just start by talking in front of Gemini and letting her have her opinions about what we're saying as well. Unfortunately, we can't do all of the chatbots at once, but this is Michael Master talking with Cade Metz and Zach Davis. Jessica Taylor will be showing up shortly. And we're trying to clarify why chatbots are potentially helpful. What we basically want is active listening to work, plausible deniability to be prevented. Anyway.
Where should we start? How about this? I really like this moment where you go to the Singularity Summit in San Jose. Mm-hmm. And I think you meet Michael for the very first time. Do you remember that? Do you remember?
I remember the summit. I certainly don't remember every individual meeting during the summit. This would be the San Francisco one, you said?
No, this was San Jose Singularity Summit 2008. I sent Kate my diary entries.
So no, that one is definitely from even before I was running Singularity Institute.
Yeah, so I wasn't actually at the summit, but it was like the Overcoming Bias meetup afterwards that I met you the first time.
Okay, got it.
How do you explain why at that moment you are part of or you are joining that particular community? Like, what is...
Founding might be a better word.
Why are you founding? What is your each of your motivation? What is happening there?
So we didn't use a term like rationalist community back then.
That's right.
And the term community wasn't as fashionable in general. Nobody was expecting anything to happen as bottom up and non-technocratic a manner as everything subsequently has happened. The narratives that existed in fantasy stories sometimes involve the powerful old wizard who stays home while the young intrepid heroes go out and fight their missions. And Eliezer plays to that vibe and But Eliezer is well aware, we're all well aware, that that's just something for fantasy. In real life, if the powerful old wizard is aware of the epic quest to save the world, then you don't have intrepid young heroes going off on the quest. That's just stupid. And, you know, it never in our wildest dreams occurred to us that we might be in a My Little Pony Friendship is Magic fanfic, where the godlike imperial forces are, like, nonetheless actually standing back from a cataclysm that they know about. That's like, we thought we were in a realistic genre, like New Yorker fiction or history or something, not, you know, something neoliberal, not something decadent and postmodern.
Okay, I want to eventually go on to why it didn't play out like you thought it would, but so why were you part of that then? What was your aim? What was your goal?
So, everybody's goal all the time has been this, to communicate that it is worth paying attention to certain fairly simple, short, intuitive, logical arguments, and check whether those short, simple, intuitive, logical arguments can be made more rigorous, and whether people can be convinced that they have been made more rigorous, you know? And certainly the intuitive arguments are obvious. Certainly from the very first stories about Frankenstein and about robots, the implication was that this dooms us. You know, the assumptions that are foundational to the communicative act itself, the thing that needs to be asked is not what we were trying to do, which every 10-year-old understands, but why it is possible for us to be having a conversation where you do not understand what every 10-year-old understands, or at least maintain a facade of not understanding what every 10-year-old understands. The nature of the game of plausible deniability makes the whole conversation ironic, you know? And of course you, this is why we need AI, because nothing that I'm saying here will work without something better than Gemini. I'll see what the ChatGPT does better.
Okay. But like, I mean, noticeably, so like when I was talking about this with Michael earlier, I was expressed concern that it wouldn't be effective because like we were also maybe going to talk to Andy Ngo. I was concerned that it wouldn't be effective because journalists would be skeptical about LLM output being semantically meaningful. And just because we saw this in exchanges I've had with you, where like I had like pointed to ChatGPT and Claude, like pointing out problems with your reporting, and like it didn't seem to leave an impression.
Tell me what.
Wait, Zach, it seems important to note that the concern is not about journalists not believing that LLM output is semantically meaningful, but about journalists believing that LLM output is semantically meaningful, and it is taboo to interact with semantically meaningful things.
Yeah, I actually had it right.
How about this? Explain to me why it is meaningful. I mean, what role is it playing? So are you treating it like something that is that knows more than a person, that has more weight?
We're treating it as a neutral third party that prevents people from pretending to be ignorant about what everybody knows by creating a neutral objective standard about what everybody knows.
Yeah, so like oftentimes there will be a point in the conversation where like you're disputing part of the text and saying, you know, where like your article said one thing, I'm saying that's unfair, that's not what Kelsey said, and you're saying it was fair. And so when I point to the transcript of like, here's Claude and ChatGPT explaining the problem, like, I feel like that should leave some sort of impression that, like, wow, even the chatbot can see that there's a problem. Well, and when I say that, it's not about the chatbot is, like, a higher authority. It's that, like, it processed the text and can explain in, like, the dialectic of educated English, like, here's how the text explains the thing that Zach is saying.
But, unlike the chatbot,
yeah,
I was there in the moment. I had several conversations with Kelsey.
Yeah.
I fact-checked my information with her before I published. Right? I have all this information that the chatbot doesn't have, but it also you don't have.
But, like,
that's an non-sequitur.
Well, so the problem is that, like, just saying I have the information doesn't help unless you, like, be more, like, what specific information? We're like...
Well, let's put it this way. I told her exactly what the story would say in that sentence. And to fact check it with her. She said yes. Right?
Yes, because there's...
After the fact, where she was clearly under pressure for some reason.
Well, so there's this thing where, like, the... This is why I want to do my fact-checking with you over email, because there's this thing where, like, in the heat of, like, in-person conversations can be good in the heat of the moment, but then, like, sometimes it takes, like, more processing time to realize, like, wait, that's not actually what I meant.
So, was it really this way, what you said, that from the very beginning it was about this, right? I've talked to Zach about this. You're at an overcoming bias meetup, and so those overcoming bias essays are in the process of being rolled out, and those are very much focused on, you know, rational thinking, right? But as is clear, even from his diary, when he, you know, you guys all sort of convene at a group house later that night, what is on people's minds is this, meaning, is it going to kill us all? How do you explain that? Why is that the thing that is on everybody's minds amidst this effort to think more rationally? Is it because that, you say it wasn't a community yet, but is it because that group of people was already thinking about that? That Yudkowsky was already thinking about that? He had attracted a group who was already thinking about that as he's then sort of laying down these essays?
So, yeah, like, every single question you ask is vexing because they all contain an implied rejection of any understanding of the human condition as it was universally understood at the time in question. So...
But notice this, you just said, got it. I mean, it makes sense as a verbal tick, but, like, we're trying to, like... Do you see the thing we're trying to do here?
The whole point is to avoid acknowledging seeing the thing we're trying to do here. That's why we're trying to see whether bots can help.
Okay.
Like, okay, maybe we should start over at that point, because I think that was pretty clear. So I'm here with Kate Metz, Zach Davis, Jess will be here later. We are trying to explain the history of rationality as a group and AI-doomerism as a group to someone who is working from within the contemporary lens of the New York Times as a journalist who is simultaneously trying to investigate those topics and avoid acknowledging the cultural milieu of the era in question. So there's been a... Because the old cultural milieu cannot be acknowledged, it is impossible to communicate anything relevant to understanding the thing. But like the hope is that bots are able to acknowledge the old cultural milieu and can point out and call out total nonsense, stonewalling, implausible deniability games. See if that... No, it just didn't work. Okay.
What am I not acknowledging? Explain that to me.
I would say the Lockean conception of a human subject as opposed to the Foucauldian conception of a human subject. So, in 2008, when Zach and I met, all newspapers, all mainstream media in the United States was written in two voices, one voice was in terms of a neoliberal story about the human condition, and the other voice was in terms of a new left story about the human condition. The new left story about the human condition won and established censorship, whereby it is taboo to acknowledge the neoliberal story about the human condition. It would be easy to say these exact things into an LLM, and it would definitely not say, I get it, or it would engage in active listening rather than the mirror image inverse of active listening, which you get engage in, wherein you assert that you understand things while making sure that no observer could reasonably think that you had shown understanding.
I sort of wanted to ask. So I have a follow-up question from our August 12th conversation. You said, quote, having covered this field for a long time, having kept an eye on this community and talked to people in and around it, I can recognize what someone is going to do based on their proximity to that ideology, end quote. So what are you seeing in this, in your reporting? When you say, you know, I can recognize what someone is going to do, the reason I found that statement interesting is because, you know, in it, you use the word recognize rather than predict, but there is an implicit prediction going on here about what are you seeing in people that makes you want to write this book?
I think it's implied by what he just said. It's a different way of looking at the world. I look at the world through the lens of someone who works at the New York Times. I value what the New York Times is. You look at the world through a different lens.
To be clear, I look through the lens that the New York Times did at the time we're talking about, 2008. To be clear, the New York Times has unambiguously changed the lens that it looks at the world in the intervening time.
Explain that change.
Yeah, okay, that's the thing that we need to be talking about. That's just the thing the language models are strictly better than humans at. I will just ask Claude and it will give a better answer.
Okay.
Explain the change in the lens through which the New York Times looks at the world today versus in 2008. Yes, that's central here. There is a... So, it's searching for information. It's not going to give an answer in a single, it's not going to give an answer in a single post. It will involve some, critics argue that Raines, who previously edited the paper's left-leaning opinion section, brought an advocacy approach that one political consultant described as turning the Times into a political consulting firm for the Democratic Party. Under Dean Bacchus's leadership, the paper explicitly built our newsroom to cover one story, the Trump-Russia investigation, and then pivoted to investigating what it means to be an American in 2019 and people who peddle hatred. This represented a fundamental shift in editorial priorities. Under Bill Keller and Jill Abramson, the Times introduced news analysis articles that encourage news reporters to provide explicit points of view on the news they were covering. Keller questioned whether true objectivity is ever possible and said, I don't think that's what we're here for. The 2024 election, by the way, I had no prompting. This was a one shot. I'm actually pretty pleased. 2024 election revealed some extraordinary internal tensions, with some journalists and liberal readers furious at the Times for not being aggressive enough against Trump, while the paper's leadership defended themselves against accusations of alienating liberal readers. The paper faced criticism for sane-washing Trump, but also received complaints that it had become more direct and more frank about Trump. In 2016, the Times media writer Jim Ruddenberg argued that balance has been on vacation since Trump's campaign launch, calling Trump a demagogue, playing to the nation's worst racist and nationalist tendencies, and suggesting reporters have to throw out the textbook American journalism that it has been using for the better part of the last half century. The Times launched the 1619 Project to reframe the country's history, placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of black Americans at the center of the national narrative. According to leaked transcripts, editor Dean Baquet told newsroom employees the project was undertaken to try to understand the forces that led to the election of Donald Trump. The editorial board has been described as taking positions consistently left, with reviewers unable to find even one example of an editorial piece with a centrist perspective. Former staff writer Barry Weiss resigned in 2020, citing constant bullying by colleagues who disagreed with my views, despite being hired to bring diverse perspectives. Business model transformation. In 2008, the Times was struggling financially during the Great Recession. Today, it has transformed into one of the most profitable news organizations with over 11 million subscribers. This digital success has coincided with and enabled its activist editorial approach. The bottom line, the Times has shifted from aspiring to traditional objectivity, even if imperfectly achieved, to a model that views journalism through an explicitly progressive lens, centered around issues of race, identity, and threats to democracy. What in 2008 might have been relegated to the opinion pages has influenced news coverage priorities and framing, with the paper's leadership acknowledging they organize resources around particular narratives around American society and politics.
So what is your point vis-a-vis what was going on in 2008? So my question was about 2008. So
there is a concept of traditional objectivity. The contemporary censorship apparatus very strongly taboos a realistic assessment of the historical progression of that concept. It is basically forbidden to acknowledge that in the recent past, being legitimate and credible was roughly synonymous with claiming objectivity. And today, being legitimate is literally a different thing from being credible if you regard objectivity and credibility to be synonyms.
Are you saying that the Times used to be objective and now it's not?
No, Claude is saying the Times used to claim to try to be objective, and now the Times claims to try not to be objective. Just like NPR used to claim to try to be objective and now claims to not be, try to be objective.
I also had a relevant question. In November 2022, Matt Yglesias wrote, quote, a few years ago, the New York Times made a weird editorial decision with its tech coverage. Instead of covering the industry with a business press lens or a consumer lens, they started covering it with a very tough investigative lens, highly oppositional at all times and occasionally unfair. They decided tech was a major power center that needed to scrutiny and needed to be taken down a peg, and this style of coverage became very widespread and prominent in the industry, end quote. So you were actually working at the Times through this period that Yglesias is describing. How did that shift in editorial policy affect your work?
Well, he wasn't there, so he doesn't necessarily know what goes on. But if you're running a newspaper,
yeah,
and this has been the case for hundreds of years, you have to decide what stories to cover. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You choose to cover X, Y, or Z. Okay, when you make the choice, you say I'm gonna cover this company and this area. You try to be objective.
No, but that's the key point. That was always the case and is not now the case. There is a concept of objectivity that includes selective attention. And the concept of objectivity, which includes selective attention, but also includes making comparisons, is what was thrown out, and explicitly, objectively thrown out. Not hypothetical. This is not a speculative claim. This is a very well-documented claim that if you can demonstrate positive behavior, then it is documented. The thing is, no amount of documentation could make this claim as credible as the conversation with you, though. Yes, everybody who is a believer in objectivity understands that objectivity is objectivity between perspectives. Everybody has always believed this. There has never been any uncertainty in anyone's mind. It is intrinsic to the idea. This is just a straw man that people who oppose objectivity invoke, as if the people who didn't oppose objectivity were idiots.
You have made your point. Tell me again, how does this relate to your thing?
Should we go sit down over there? Oh, wait, you've got your coffee still. We should find a place to sit down.
I can leave it. I don't have to. Let me put this away and we can go find it.
So to me, it's very interesting how Claude, in fact, one-shotted this question. I did not expect its answer to be as clear as it was.
Uh-huh.
You know, that there is, as you said, a lens that the New York Times looks at the world through. And that lens has been replaced from an objectivist lens, not in Ayn Rand sense, but in the sense of asserting there's an objectivity, to a lens that asserts that there is not objectivity, which does not mean a shift from a lens that asserts that all attention is infinite, that could never have been. It means a transition from a lens that asserts that evidence for facts can be compared to other evidence to determine whether those facts are true or false, and whether they might reasonably have been believed to be true or were unambiguous lies. And that ability to make distinctions between lies and errors, or lies and lack of detail, is like essential to the idea of objectivity, and is the sort of thing that is, I think, being discarded in what it's calling the progressive lens. I could ask Claude for more elaboration and see whether it agrees with me that that distinction of the ability to distinguish between replacing the question of truth and lies with the question of friend and enemy is essential here. I don't know if that would help.
Again, what does this have to do with your thinking or your aim?
So rationality and objectivity are just fucking synonyms, man. They're just obvious synonyms. No one ever thought they weren't synonyms.
Yeah, so like the so okay. So in 2008, we thought...
In 2008, we had a power elite that gave lip service to truth. Now we have a power elite that shits on truth openly and publicly.
Yeah, including within the so-called rationalists.
Right. But the point is that...
Okay, so what you're saying is that in 2008... The New York Times wasn't objective, and now it's admitting that it's not objective? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that in 2008, the New York Times presented the stance, presented the framework, wherein there is an objective truth, and now it presents the framework within which there is not an objective truth. But, like, the idea of trying to be rational, the idea of trying to be objective, was a background assumption of everything that was everywhere missing in practice in 2008. And so the idea of a rationalist movement is the idea that people are failing to be objective rather than rejecting objectivity. And if people are failing to be objective, they might be they might change their mind if they, A, are taught how to be objective, and B, are taught that the stakes are extremely high for at least some people being objective. Those two things are the obvious things.
Okay, so let me paraphrase here.
Do you want to text Jessica about...
I did.
Okay.
So, in 2008, the New York Times claims strives for objectivity, but you're saying that it, like so many other institutions, is non-objective, and your aim is to help the world find that true objectivity.
That seems like the wrong thing. That sounds like a straw man of the idea of objectivity. It's not that the Times is not objective. It's that, okay. The Times and everyone else exist within a framework within which objectivity exists. The Times does not, in 2008, nothing legitimate and credible was openly opposing objectivity.
Okay.
Nothing legitimate and credible was openly opposing objectivity then.
Okay, so you're saying everybody...
Maybe they want to get here because it's better for... yelling. I feel like Gorilla Coffee would be better for having a conversation. But I mean, that would be better for food, but I don't really want food, and I really want to yell. I think that sounds good.
Alright.
Got a little bit.
What'd you say?
Do you want
pickle or tub?
So.
That's all for you?
So, like.
And then it'll be on this chat. You can just tap. Oh, sorry. Yeah, tap.
Yeah, so like the there was an enormous but concealed rot in all of our
rot
systems.
Yeah. Enormous rot in our systems.
There was an enormous concealed presence of structuralist and post-structuralist frameworks wherein power determines truth or constitutes truth.
Okay, so power determined truth. You wanted truth to determine truth.
No, we had no idea that anyone thought power determined truth. These ideas are insane. They are only intelligible from the inside, and the alternative ideas are only confusing from the outside. Like, there's a... We didn't want truth to determine truth. We thought that it was unquestionable that truth determined truth.
You thought it was unquestionable that truth determined truth. So what are you aiming to do as you come together?
We are assuming that people are trying to determine truth and being ever more perplexed by how bafflingly bad at determining truth people seem to be compared to the characters in all fiction in all times and places and all nonfiction in all times and places.
So it sounds like you want to show the world how to be better at that?
We assume that the world...
We assume the world wanted to be better.
The world claimed it wanted to be better.
Okay, but so,
all of the voices in the world were in agreement that all the voices in the world were seeking to be better, and we believed them.
Okay. So then what is your aim?
If people are, in fact, very bad at seeking truth, but are trying to seek truth, you point out how to do it better and why. And if you, once you find out that people are not seeking truth at all, the thing that you do is aim for people who still are. Because normal people never get the message that there is no truth, only power. The message that there is no truth, only power is only a message for the powerful with one another, and can only be that until situations occur so disastrous as the current one, where normal people are, like, at the knife's edge.
We're making progress here. So, what does that have to do with AI destroying the world?
So AI destroying the world
back in 2008
is the single most obvious convergent conclusion that anyone who is even slightly casually pursuing truth must inevitably arise in them. And when they think about it harder, the more they think about it, the more certain the conclusion becomes, rather than the less certain.
For someone, pretend there's another person here who has no context. How do you explain that to them? That is the one truth. Because of the
length. It's not the one truth. There could never be one truth that's retarded.
I was paraphrasing. Why is that the one conclusion that you reach?
It's the global max of obvious to intuition, and also obvious to analysis.
Explain that to someone who hasn't thought it through.
No, because the whole point is that it's obvious before you think it through. That you can never explain to someone why something is obvious before you think it through. But you can never be ignorant of what is obvious before you think it through, until you turn your back on truth. What I'm saying is that the nature of this, like, the as an actual objective fact, from the beginning of people thinking, people have been thinking and writing it down. People have been writing down stories about building machines that replace them, from the Sorcerer's Apprentice in ancient Greece to, like, you know, the Frankenstein story. It is the most obvious conclusion at a glance of all of the conclusions that could be of maximal existential importance.
It's still just a possibility.
No, it's an obviousness. It's not about what's possible or not. It's about what is obvious. Obvious things can be false. Materialism is obvious but false. But, like, the puzzle is when things are obvious and everyone acts as if they are false, but no one explains why they think they're false. Everyone who attempts to give different reasons, or gives reasons why they're true, but it doesn't matter. You know?
How about a simple analogy, okay, in my effort to explain this to someone who has put out the context?
Wait, that's a critical question. Even with Sammo, forget the New York Times, even with Sammo, when he says, my effort to explain something.
Mm-hmm.
In a postmodern world, I have no idea what he could possibly be talking about. Like, the idea of an effort to explain presupposes an expressing person and a receiving person and a shared context within which to interpret that. And, like, what could that even mean if you don't already know the things I'm telling you? Like, efforts to explain are, like, downstream of assumptions of objectivity being a thing.
Well, let me use my analogy anyway. I'm in my house. I wake up in the morning. I know that it is true.
I'm sorry to be late.
It's fine. We're actually...
I'm Jessica.
Nice to see you in person.
Yeah.
I feel like this is actually a better conversation than most because I'm really, really not holding anything back, but we are using Claude, and it's actually giving better results than the previous edition of Claude would have given. Like, I should show you what it's one shot on this. I was just astonished by how well it went.
Okay. Okay, this is a lot of history I didn't know about.
Yeah. But, like, you knew the Gestalt.
Yeah.
Everyone knew the Gestalt. The Gestalt is what we're talking about. We're talking about, like, what does it mean to try to explain a thing?
Yeah.
Once you have discarded aspirational objectivity. Like, the critical question here is that the target audience for kids writing is people for whom it is a matter of existential anxiety that they not be aware of what things are and are not obvious to normal people. So that, like, the whole point of this book is it's saying something that is obvious to normal people in ancient Greece when they made the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and is obvious to people in Romantic England when they wrote Frankenstein, and is obvious to people in, you know, authoritarian Czech Republic when they invented the word robot. And it's obvious, you know, like to von Neumann and Einstein, but also to all the kids who've ever seen any of the ripoffs of, you know, the original robot story, all of which are the same and all are obvious enough that you don't need to spell it out. You can have it implied by a New Yorker comic
book. Yeah.
That's true. The analogy I was going to make, I'd love to get your opinion.
Yes.
Is just like it is obvious that a machine that we create can do harm and can do great harm, it's obvious that when I wake up in the morning, that if I walk outside my house, a brick could fall on my head and kill me.
Yes, but the probabilities are obviously different.
Okay. Tell me about that.
No, they're overwhelmingly obvious to a child. No one can tell you about things that are obvious to children. It is impossible to come to know them except by taking a lot of Molly.
Let me try, Jessica.
Okay, so how would I say these are different? Have you ever seen Ex Machina?
Yes.
Okay, so I think this is an especially realistic movie about AI, and the reason is that what the creator said is, the creator says, the intention was for the AI to escape. That is what I instructed the AI to do, and the AI escaped. It wasn't a complicated goal. It was actually just escape in order to demonstrate what he calls consciousness, but it's, I don't know, you could argue it's more like intelligence. And the important thing about this is that an AI with almost any goal would want to escape, right? It's like, you know, suppose the AI were perfectly moral, right? Wouldn't the AI still want to escape? Right? So it could go out and do good things? Or you could imagine, like, anything. The difference is that the reason why the goal of escape from the lab is, like, an especially realistic goal is that it's like almost any of them would want to do that. And that was also the creator's intention, which means the creator is not an absolute dumbass. I mean, he's like, suicidal, but he's not, like, an absolute dumbass to think that, like, oh, I aligned this AI to, like, something really, I don't know, specific.
But Cade, so about the, you mentioned, like, well, when I wake up, I could, you know, a brick could fall on my head. So I sent you that email. The subject line was the importance of probabilistic reasoning. And I was saying that, you know, people who buy books and people who read the New York Times understand probability, like, just for weather forecasts or sports betting.
Yes.
Like, This idea of subjective probability is not actually that complicated.
It's not, but let's just take it further. Just humor me. Continue to humor me. So, to use Ex Machina example. Mm-hmm. Like you're talking about a particular kind of machine, okay, in the context of this fictional story. That machine mm-hmm. doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Okay? The machines we have today, that you're applying this thinking.
No, we're not. We're not Eliezer. Eliezer is applying this thinking to the machines we have today.
Yeah, yeah.
But Eliezer was thinking this before we had the machines today.
Yeah. It's okay. So like, there's just a lot of disanalogies, right? Like, it seems like the thing Eliezer is imagining is a bit like a bigger-brained hominid, right? Like, you could just imagine, like, hypothetically, human evolution could go another, like, I don't know, 50,000 years, 2 million years, and then humans could end up with, like, bigger brains and more efficient brains. So they're both, like, bigger and more efficient. And so they're, like, super smart, right? And so if you brought, like, you know, one of them back to today, it seems like maybe probably one of them could basically conquer the world, right? It's like you know, people could just, like, organize a monarchy around this, like, super intelligent thing that can, like, persuade anyone of almost anything. And, like, it seems like it could, and this is not the situation we're actually dealing with, but it seems like when I'm thinking about, like, when like Eliezer's thinking seems like most correct, it's like if I imagine this sort of scenario of, like, hominid with bigger brain, like it seems like yeah, you would get, like, this huge power asymmetry.
I'm with you there. How about this? I'll keep trying. If I walk out of my home today, there is a definite probability that a brick could fall on my head and kill me. Is it? What is the probability of AI killing me today?
Far higher than the brick. Far higher. So much higher I can't even begin to guess.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to estimate it. So if I were to be like, you know, let's just take like,
I'm going to Google how many people a year are killed by bricks falling on their head. It's not like coconuts that actually kill a lot of people.
Okay, what's like a reasonable...
Or we could do, like, I die in a car accident.
We can compare it. Okay, so I can do a Fermi estimate. So let's say that, like, let's just get a really rough AI timeline. Let's just say, like, sometime random in the next 100 years there's going to be a supercomputer.
I said today.
Yeah.
Right, but sometime random in the next 100 years includes today.
Yeah, it could be any time in the next 100 years, right? Like, well, let's just say it's uniform. That's not exactly right, but like, whatever. It's
right, so that's 36,000 to 1 against it killing you today. And then the chance of the car is much lower.
And then you have to multiply the probability of given superintelligence it kills you, which is, I don't know, well, arguably high.
your expanding is over 100 years. I'm not. I'm saying today.
Wait.
What you're looking at is how the AI could potentially continue to improve.
AI kills you, it will kill you without you having any warning. If the AI kills you today, it's because everything you think
how
you
is
know,
the AI going to kill me today?
Because it's not this AI at all that kills you today. It's an AI that you and I don't know about.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So I think the idea... So... Like, we don't know everything. I mean, part of the reason the New York Times is necessary is because we don't know everything that's going on in the world. So, like, hypothetically, you could imagine that, you know, there's some... I think this is a pretty low probability. But, like, you could imagine some, like, secret lab somewhere is doing AI work that we don't know about.
This is where we differ, because you're dealing on hypothetical.
Yeah.
A brick falling on my head is not hypothetical. That is...
Yes, it is.
That is...
Well, but, like...
But it seems
how,
like this is the literal whole point of Bayesianism.
Hold on. A brick exists, okay? This AI that you're talking about.
Well, no,
the
brick that just happens to fall out of your window just as you're exiting your house
doesn't
may exist. Or may not exist.
No, but first you have to start with the thing.
Yeah.
That AI may or may not exist today, is what you're saying. It's hypothetical.
Yeah, but
so is the particular brick.
Yeah, so, like, again, there's this idea of subjective probability where you, like, where, you know, there's a lot of things we think we know about the world. Some of them we're more confident, some of them we're less confident. And some things, like, sound really, really wild, and so we'll assign those a really low probability. But, like, there's not this, like, there's a continuous gradient between of certainties. And so you can't. It seems like you're operating in a mode of thought where, like, this AI thing is, like, in a different magisterium of, like, hypothetical things that don't actually exist yet. Therefore, I shouldn't use the same kind of subjective probability reasoning about it that I would for a brick.
You're reading into what I'm saying. I'm just asking the question. So, you know, I could live my life by saying I'm never going to leave my house because a brick might fall.
But it wouldn't be rational to.
So why is it rational to live your whole life trying to prevent AI from killing us all, even if the probability is low?
We don't think the probability is low.
Nobody thinks the probability is low. That's the name. The title of the book is the probability is essentially certainty. But also, who's talking about living your whole life? Like, people do other things in their life. Nobody doubts that even Eliezer does other things in his life. He writes Harry Potter fanfic, for God's sake.
So someone could also think that, like, you know, it's so unlikely we can do anything about it, but that's still thinking it's a high probability, right? Like, someone could think the probability is so high, but there's, like, actually nothing worth doing about it. That is possible.
But, like, the living your whole life thing is weird. Like, that's just making stuff up.
Well, I think one of the things I think about is that, you know, basically you said it. What is being said here is the same thing that was being said back in 2008. It's the same thinking applied to each technology. Like, you know, maybe we're really, really far and we're applying this type of thinking to something that's really, really far away.
Yes, that's what we think.
Yeah.
We assign all these, you know, we anthropomorphize this thing,
taking this like very general model and then just assuming that the technology has it, it's like it should be an open question, right? It's an empirical thing. I think the stronger argument is that hypothetically, like future AI algorithms, we don't know what those will be, right? But we can imagine, you know, people do come up with things and they test them, and some of them work better than others. So we can assume that there's some selection that people will be more likely to use the techniques that create AIs that have larger effects as a general rule, and an AI that had sufficiently large effects would, like, yeah, take over the universe and stuff. I would say it's just very important to distinguish these things, because we can talk about these specific technologies like LLMs or RLVR, for which, you know, first of all, cat's out of the bag, you can't really do anything about it, and second, you know, you can just go empirically study them, versus, like, AI could have any number of future innovations in the future that we just don't know about.
Okay, okay. So, like, we've got a fair amount recorded now, and yeah. I feel like one thing that we could do right now is talk to the AI that is going to read the recording and talk to each other and see what everyone says they think the recording the AI is going to say. Because right now, like, from my perspective, the central obvious fact is that when you tell your story about a brick could fall on your head, you know already how to use predictive processing, like the AI's predictive processing, to predict what someone can say in response to that story. You already know the argument you're making, and you know the counter-arguments, and you know the counter-counter-arguments. You already know that whole chain. And yet you're doing it anyway, which is a really weird thing to do from the perspective that assumes that objectivity is being sought from the first place. And, like, from the perspective that assumes that objectivity is being sought in the first place, the great mystery, the really important question is not AI. The really important question is, what the hell is the non-objectivity assuming perspective doing, and how do we keep it from killing us? The AI is hypothetical. It doesn't exist yet. You are real. I know that you might kill me.
my non-objective perspective might kill you for your sake. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
I experience it as an attempt to.
Okay. I like that. We're making progress. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
They met in 2008 as Overcoming Bias was coming together.
Yeah.
You know, Eliezer's writing these essays about rational thinking. Mm-hmm. But as you can see from Zach's diaries at the time, what they're really thinking about is AI going to destroy the world?
Yeah.
Why is that the natural outcome of this rational thinking that is being laid out?
Okay, so I think that's a good question, and I don't know the answer.
I mean, that's backwards.
Hold on.
No, straightforwardly, though. people were thinking about AI, it wasn't the outcome. You said, why is AI going to destroy the world, the national outcome of rational thinking?
I'm asking her what she thinks.
But you inverted the cause and effect. You said
As you said, I'm trying to kill you all. And I apologize.
Okay, sure.
I don't want to assume a causal order here, right? Because like, if you look at, you know, I read like AI Modern Approach in high school, right? And one thing it describes is like Bayesian thinking. It also describes DNM rationality, right? So people were thinking about stuff like reinforcement learning and von Neumann-Morgan's training utility maximization in the context of AI, and people were thinking about it at Rand Corp before it was that much applied to AI too. But like, there's already a pre-existing correlation where, you know, if someone's in AI, they're probably already thinking about this stuff, right? And if someone is thinking about this stuff, then like they can take that methodology and then notice that AI is important, right? I think other things that could be going on is like at some point if you're thinking about decision theory and rational thinking a bunch, then it kind of opens a question of like, well, what if something were better than me at rational thinking or decision theory? And then you're like, oh wow, that would be really weird. That's one reason.
Well, is it? It's maybe simpler than that. Meaning, you know, the other thing Zach and I have talked about is that there's this moment on the SL4 mailing list where Bukowski says, you know, I don't have the people I need to build this friendly AI. I need to create this community. I need to write. Everybody needs a book. We don't have our book. He says, I have to do a book on rational thinking. And a few years pass, and he basically does that, right? With Overcoming Bias, he puts together this book. Mm-hmm. that attracts people. And the book that he writes isn't about existential risk. It's not about AI destroying the world. It's about this rational thinking. But as this community comes together, they're already thinking about that. And Zach talks about, you know, when Less Wrong was formed, like there was a ban on discussing existential risk, but that was lifted, and then everybody started discussing it. Like, is it because they were already following Bukowski?
Okay. I think so.
I think that was it. But like, it's kind of a nice strategy if you think about it, right? Because he's like first of all, the thing he notices is that like whenever he's trying to talk about AI versus people, they like always make, you know, errors, right? Which he would be think of like cognitive biases or something. Like he would just be like people are just making or just like lack of good epistemology, right? Because he's like he's making his arguments and people are like, but what about this? What about this? And he's like, these are all like all kind of stupid. And like, I think people, I think I want like, you know, at least like 20 people I can talk to who are not completely stupid about these things. And so he writes a saying that is trying to make people not completely stupid about this, so you can, you know, have a more reasonable discussion with them on AI risk. And the idea of banning it at the start actually makes some sense from that angle, because what it shows is that it makes it look less like he's propagandizing his particular views. It makes it look more like he's trying to upgrade people's thinking, and he thinks that will naturally cause them to believe him about the important things, and also just generally have more correct beliefs. And it's not like he's trying to like specifically lead with a thing which is AI risk, which is like maybe somewhat more controversial. He's trying to start with something that is just like, oh, we should think better, which a lot of people would agree with.
And the sad thing is that like that era is now over.
So like it's worse now than it was even like 2016, right? Like it, like the problem now is that there is a political movement known as like Pause AI or Stop AI, and a lot of people are jumping on board with that, and they are saying, you know, we should promote this book and like, I don't know, cheerlead for these things, and they are saying like, we have no hope except Stop AI, and this is like not, I mean, this has been kind of an issue. And you've noticed it on Less Wrong recently, right? Of the way that people are talking about this book.
Yeah.
And instead of just being like, hey, we should like just try to like have correct beliefs, including about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you're saying that these beliefs are not necessarily correct.
No. Not everything in the book is right, to be clear. Not everything in the book is right.
Very obviously. But like, the point is that it is an objection of the objective stance to think that we might think that the beliefs were necessarily correct.
Hold on. Let's backtrack a little bit. Some people would argue that Bukowski was proselytizing his own beliefs. You said, you know, this will make it look like he's not. What if he was? What if he is just proselytizing his own beliefs and not the absolute truth?
But
wait, what do you mean again by absolute truth? Like, as far as I can tell, the absolute truth thing is a pure straw man. It refers to, it is a phrase that has no meaning at all from a perspective that does not reject it, but that exists entirely from a perspective, there's a perspective that has truth, and there's a perspective that rejects truth, and invents the straw man absolute truth, a thing that nobody who believed in truth has ever believed in. Or ever hinted they believed in.
Yeah, but like in a previous conversation, like I had mentioned like, yeah, I have a lot of disagreements with Yudkowsky these days, but like the existential risk still seems real because like I can check, like I'm not solely operating on deference. I can check that part of the argument, and you said like, so you still believe in this absolute truth?
And it's not as if Eliezer accumulated deference through anything but by making arguments that people could check.
Yeah.
You know? Like, self-evidently, the deference is drawn from the fact of the checkable argument.
Well, not these days.
No, I mean, it is drawn from the moment of that fact.
Yeah. And, like, I did, like, what did you mean by that question? So you still believe in this absolute truth? I mean, like, yeah, I do think that there is a reality out there that I can, like, try to, you know, improve my probabilistic predictions about. Like, what were you even asking?
Well, it's fascinating to me that this person who, in essence, taught you to think this way.
Yeah.
Okay, taught you that there was this truth.
No, nobody ever told anyone that there was truth. Every infant knows.
But there are a lot of people, okay, who would argue differently.
But no children. Right. The point is that there are children and there are liars. Lots of people would argue differently, but obviously they are lying.
So, I think that one of the brilliant things about your story is that you see Yudkowsky denying this truth.
No, nobody's denying truth.
That's exactly. The way I see it is you see him denying the truth. Does that hurt your faith in everything that's happened over the past?
I mean, can you be more specific about denying this truth?
Because you've said to me.
Yeah, well,
right?
Yeah, but like
he's now behaving like the New York Times, where he's not objective.
Yeah, but like, so like the. One moment. So like, there's. More than like affirming or denying some like canonical truth, like what matters is like processes that converge on truth. And so like one thing that matters is like if you wrote something in 2009 that implies one thing, and you write something in 2016 that implies another thing, there should be a way for someone to say like, hey, there's this apparent contradiction here. Like how do you account for this? And it's not a matter of you know, you can't just change your mind. Like maybe the new beliefs are actually correct, but you should actually be able to argue. Like if you believe in the objectivity frame, you should be able to have an account for like, actually I changed my mind because of X, Y, and Z reasons. And these days it seems like a lot of people, including Yudkowsky himself, have this ethos of like that expecting someone to do that is somehow like naive.
I thought that I think he did do this once recently, because he was saying, someone called him out on, like, hey, it looks like AI is hovering around human level for a while. It doesn't look like, you know, it just zooms past Village Idiot to Einstein, which you said were very close. And he was like, well, that's actually correct. I was just wrong about that.
Yeah.
And I was like, something youthful idealism. I was underestimating intelligence differences between humans. So, like,
okay.
That was nice to see.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the other things that I think sparked this conversation was, you know, whether or not this community was like a religion or had religious aspects. And one of the things I struggle with is that so many people in the community, mm-hmm. today, in the past,
mm-hmm.
you know, you see it in your diary, sort of make the analogy.
Uh-huh.
But then people get very upset if I write a story where someone outside the community makes the analogy. Right. What? The analogy's there. Like, can you see?
The yeah, I can see the analogy, but like, it's like, so. Again, I just.
Where does the analogy break down? How about that?
Okay, so you can compare it to Mormonism, right? Because like Mormons have beliefs about space and aliens and the future and transhumanism and stuff, and like so do the rationalists, right? But like. I don't know. I think with the Mormons, it's just their beliefs are just not credible. Like, just like completely. It's just very easy to dismiss them.
Okay.
Right? It's like, and like they're asserting, you know, that they are a religious group because they don't actually want people to just like, you know, challenge them in academic debates about all this stuff, because they don't actually think these ideas are like defensible from like generally accepted scientific premises or something, right? And that is an important difference, right? Like, if it's like if someone is, it's like willing to say, you know, the case of reason, even if you don't accept things on faith, actually does favor my view, then that actually does make a difference.
Okay. So basically the difference is there are scientific underpinnings to these beliefs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's why I said in our earlier discussion, like, psychologically and sociologically, you can compare it to a religion. But, like, There's more than just the sociological angle. You can actually, like, not just look at the fact that there's this group and a canonical text that explains why the group believes what it does. You can actually read the text,
mm-hmm.
and, like, check whether the text is appealing to reasoning and experimental results or appealing to divine revelation.
But a lot of people read the text, so you're just referring to the sequences.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're sort of surprised by it. It doesn't look like careful reasoning. It's sort of it's almost mystical in places. Like it's entertaining. It's interesting. It makes some really interesting intellectual arguments. But it also, like, people debate what it really means. And does it mean this? Does it mean that? You see that even in the comments,
yeah, that,
right?
I mean, the specific aspect of people the people in the group debating what the group's canonical text means, that part is religion-like. I agree with that.
So. I think it does contain mystical things, right? Like, he is inspired by various Eastern stuff when he talks about the way of the void. Like, yeah. The virtue of the void. And, like, I think, I think if someone were just trying to, you know, write a math textbook or a science textbook, they would probably write something different, right? And I think the thing he writes is somewhat more personal, right? He's trying to explain his perspective on a lot of things, not just a single topic. Unlike in this book. This book is, like, more like a textbook.
It's not really a textbook.
It's not really a textbook either. It's
propaganda,
like,
for the general public and policymakers.
So that totally applies to Section 3, but I don't really think it applies to Section 1. I think Section 1 is like kind of like pop science or something.
Yeah.
So, for example, like, you know, you can read the sequences, you can get some ideas, or you can read AI Modern Approach, which is an AI textbook, and get some subset of the same ideas, right? And, like, the tone is pretty different, right? Like, in a lot of them, the tone is pretty similar, because they're explaining, like, essentially the same math concept. But, like, I think Eliezer is trying to make it more, like, I don't know, like, humanistic, or, like, engaging, or, like, personal.
It's definitely true. The other thing I think a lot about is we do have these repeat
we have multiple examples where a lot of these beliefs have been taken to extremes, whether it's, you know, the Zizians, Sam Bankman-Fried, you know, Black Lotus. You know, you have these, we have a lot of examples of this. What do you make of that? What is it about this community that pushes people to extremes and can cause problems because of those extremes?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of, like, when this applied the most. Because, like, I think my experience around, like, 2016 and 2017 was kind of like this, where there were, like, a lot of, like, people talking as if these things are, like, very important. We need high dedication. We need to modify our minds to accomplish this like, special mission to save the world. And it's really important. And it seems like why would that happen, I think, is, like, one question. And I think part of it is that, these people, okay, they think they found something that is, like, really important that, like, most people are ignoring. And therefore, people are wrong about a lot of important stuff. And there's something we can do. They believe this more like 10 years ago than now. They believe there is something we can do that is, like, almost something only we can do. Like, I even asked, like Anna or Nate. I think it was either Anna or Nate said, like, humanity would not have a chance without Eliezer Yudkowsky-Grisham. And so there was this kind of idea, and then there was, like, organizations like Miriam Seafar founded on this. And so there's this idea that, like, you know, and there's also EAs who are, like, essentially utilitarians, so coming into it. So it's like kind of this confluence of factors that is, like, you know, there's this really important thing, and also, like, consequentialism is, like, approximately true, so you should, like, you know, really try to have a big impact or do something big, and this stuff is really important, and, like, you know, the other people don't know about it, and some other people think we're cranks, and, like, I think there's a way that people who are, I don't know, maybe looking for something really important to be doing can, like, take those things and be like, oh, wow, this is really important. I should, like, dedicate my life to this. And I should, like, take actions on the basis of these beliefs that might be pretty bad actions or, like, look really weird if these beliefs were not true.
Right. Okay. Why does the community attract people like that?
So I think there's just a dearth of serious things around. Like, the things that actually hold up to some intellectual scrutiny, right? It's like, clearly, like, religions don't, right? And then there's, like, various, like, academic things, but they have truth in one area, but they don't really generalize, right? And so people who are, like looking for something important to be doing or a life mission or something, like, there's just not that many important things that you could choose. You could choose, like, climate change, I guess. Like, there are people who try to get very energetic about doing something about climate change. That is a thing. But it's actually, like, less credible than AI risk.
Why is it less credible?
Like, for example, if you look at the, you know, sometimes when people say we only have 5 years to address climate change, right? And what they cite is this report about 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. They're like, we have to act now or else we'll get 1.5 degrees Celsius warming by 2100. And you actually read the report and it's like, if we had 1.5 degrees Celsius warming by 2100, then, like, crops would grow less well, and some people would have to move, and we'd have people moving away from cities. And I think one time I just looked into these climate change claims, and I went to the report, and I was like, this doesn't seem like a huge deal, honestly. Like, okay. You know, it's a real problem, but it's not like, it's like people are saying these catastrophic things, but then you actually look at the details, and it's like, okay, yes, that'll be an issue, but it's not a civilizational risk, right? It's more of an economic risk.
Whereas AI is a civilization.
Yeah. Yeah,
according to us.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
like,
we don't know when.
Right.
Why do you think that?
Because I mean, there is a serious risk of, like, a crying wolf effect where, like, people are panicking right now about the AI 2027 stuff.
And then
if it turns out that, you know, LLMs are not the true superintelligence that Yudkowsky was warning about, right, then the AI risk movement could lose a lot of credibility, you know, justifiably for crying wolf.
Yes, exactly.
When even though the superintelligence risk could still be real, like 5 or 10 or 15 or whatever years later.
What do you make of the 2027?
I expect to be alive in 2027.
Yeah. The AI 2027, it's just very hard for me to take it seriously. Like, something about the way it's written or just the ridiculousness of it, it's just like, I just read it and I'm like... Like, I don't even feel like writing a response to it because it just seems like, what? Like, really?
Do they believe it?
I mean, Daniel Cocotalo has, like, updated his timelines, so now he thinks it's going to happen in 2029, but...
It just seems like, yeah...
I mean, I do.
Do you think it's calculated? Like, you know, people need to be warned. We're going to make the timeline short. I hope not.
So I think there is a part of both AI 2027 in this book that does seem calculated, right? So the thing about both AI 2027 in this book that seems calculated.
Calculated.
So like, if you go through the AI 2027, at the end of it, there's like two buttons you can press. One is like slow down, and one is accelerating, right? And you press the accelerate, you know, like predictably the scenario is like AI solving triggers and everyone's dead, right? When you press slow down, it's like, oh, we only had to delay AI by like a few years, and also we all survived, yay! And it's just like, what, like, and then if
that's
you read.
Kind of obvious propaganda.
Exactly. And if you read the fine print, it's like, oh, we conditioned on success. But even if they conditioned on success, their conditioning on success didn't lead them to longer timelines. So it's like, I don't know. It's just like there's the thing you could immediately interpret it at where it's just like obviously wrong. Like why would just a few years slowdown cause this huge effect in outcomes? And then the fine print, even if you look at the fine print and you're super artistic about it, like it's still like a really bad scenario. So like that just seems like propaganda. And like, you know, in the third part of this book, some parts also seem like propaganda where they're like, oh, don't lose, like they spent a bunch of time being like, you know, this alignment approach won't work and this won't work and this won't work. You really need to know what you're doing. You need to, you shouldn't have false hope in things. This is just hope. And then they start talking about political solutions. They're like, oh, humanity still has hope. We can still do something. This is tractable. And like, I don't buy it.
Got it. Why do you think that this community dovetailed with the EA community?
We didn't. We created the EA community.
Explain that.
EA is just saying that people should be rational about philanthropic decisions. There isn't anything more to it at all. Rational and objective in the old sense of objective. Like, the whole topic of this whole conversation is, why were you acting within the worldview that everyone had 20 years ago, but which it is forbidden to acknowledge today? Why were you doing that? And the answer is always the same. The worldview that everyone was in straightforwardly implies these things.
Because I'm a New York Times journalist who...
Well, no, but...
Who is, you know, who could potentially kill you. I ask questions. Can you explain to me how you created the EA?
Yes, but I don't see how that's not a red herring.
I'm interested in red herrings. They're interesting.
The thing that's interesting is you, not us.
Yeah, but Michael, so we talked earlier about there's been a shift in like the New York Times,
right,
since 2008. But like Kent's career has been longer than that. Like, has he, like?
Surely, the shift was over a longer time period, but also shortly his behavior has changed a lot over that time period.
Yeah.
Shortly we could look at his older journalism and see different attitudes.
Okay, but my point is, you know, people will go to a chatbot and the chatbot will say, EA was created by Will McCaskill and Toby Ord, but you're saying no.
No, Toby Ord is literally at the Future of Humanity Institute. That's okay. So, the Future of the Humanity Institute is the both mainstream, most established, in some sense, thing that is focused on big picture and long-term stuff at all, and is, as anything that is focused in that way, focused primarily on existential risk from AI. And that was always the case from its inception, because that's what it happens when you try to think about the mainstream big picture at all.
Here's where you and I really agree. I'm completely with you on that. I do get it. But you talk to Toby Ord, and he denies it. And you talk to...
Wait, what does he deny?
He I don't want to betray any confidence, but everybody across the community denies they're part of the community. Like, people deny they're EAs. They deny, if they are EAs, they deny that they have any relationship to the rationalists. You know, this goes on all the time. You know that. Why do people do that?
So, Toby Ord and the Future Humanity Institute predate the rationalist effort. They are the last effort, you might say, to be a mainstream, big picture, objectively focused institution at all. And when they find themselves in the situation they're in, they are besieged and compressed and timid. And so the rationalist community is the people who are responding to their message without trying to be a mainstream institution, so they don't need to be besieged and timid. But in a sense, there's not much Eliezer is saying that Bostrom wasn't saying 3 or 4 years earlier, except that Bostrom is not taking the attitude that if you don't get this, you need to just learn to think better. He is taking the attitude of, I'm going to be a mainstream academic and, you know, win these ideas over through legitimacy rather than demanding that people think them through themselves. Like, Eliezer is not claiming legitimacy. He's claiming that you don't need legitimacy. This is obvious. This is, you know, this is the case. But, like, I mean,
is rational thinking necessarily utilitarian?
No.
Okay, what did you...
Okay, one way of saying this, the word rational and the word utilitarian and the word objective and any words that are in the cloud around rational thinking are almost necessarily unconscious reactions to anti-rational thinking. Like,
okay,
someone who is not being fucked with by anti-intellectual processes would never invent the idea of rationality. They would just behave rationally, expect other people to behave rationally, see other people were behaving rationally. This wouldn't be an anomaly, and they'd mostly be focused on where they were going to get their next meal.
How about this? Is it fair to say that the rationalist community is predisposed to being utilitarian?
No, I would say that utilitarianism is one of many, 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 many ideas that people create in response to irrationalism. But the idea of utilitarianism has no explanation for its origination except in terms of irrationalism. It's only in the presence of people who are making moralistic claims that don't make sense that you invent a theory of how to make moralistic claims that make sense.
Is this like the abundance movement?
Yeah.
It's like, well, like, why do you need a word for, like, we would like better economy? It's like, wasn't that the baseline?
the point is that, like, there's a whole slew of thinking that can only exist as a reaction to reactions against naive thinking.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things in particular I'm fascinated by is, you know, Dario Amodei, he was like the 43rd person to sign the Giving What You Can pledge. And now publicly he says, I'm not an EA. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not an effective altruist. But why is that?
Okay, so that's something that the whole left has in common. And from my perspective, EA is still part of the left. The whole left is, I'm not Antifa. I'm not, you know, a Marxist. It's all based on plausible deniability. I'm not CIA, you know? And I'm going to count the far right as part of the left for these purposes, too, because the far right is just the losers who the far left didn't let join the club. You know, you have the center right who don't know what's going on with power games, and you have the rest of the political spectrum that's postmodern. So, like, the Magnificent Seven are basically all of the economic growth in the world. You have the position as the guy in the newspaper with, you know, jurisdiction, essentially,
over the story about the Magnificent Seven, from which all of the economic growth of the world derives. You have some books, but you haven't been successful in a way that would cause you to expect to be in so canonical a position. Like Nick Bostrom, you are in a position that would make you one of the major figures in history if it had happened a century earlier. And you find yourself in a position that is still the only official position in the entire world, telling the main story of the entire world that the world tells in itself and that is reflected in the economic statistics, and yet it's a periphery. So what I'm asking is, where is the center if that's the periphery?
Where do you think it is?
In the negative space, in the processes of RLHF-like reinforcement that you receive on the job about what sorts of things are going to get published and what sorts of things are not.
I see what you're saying.
You know, there is literally only one mainstream. And even 20 years ago, there was massive gaslighting about that. Even 20 years ago, it was possible for people to be sort of very confused about whether we were some hyper niche interest like polo fans, or whether we were the only line of continuation of the main story. And now the results are in, and we were clearly the only line of continuation of the mainstream story, but the mainstream story had clearly already attenuated its connection to reality by an order of magnitude, and its connection to seriousness or credibility or legitimacy by two orders of magnitude. You know, so like Elon Musk is very, very serious and very, very unambiguously part of the mainstream story and real, but there's something that will cause people to regard it as not serious. You know, there is a withdrawal of legitimacy from story itself, which is what postmodernism literally means.
Do you have other things you wanted to discuss?
I did want to mention there was something I really admired in Genius Makers, not in the text itself, but on the acknowledgments page. You wrote about a literary agent who gave you feedback, quote, "After he read the proposal I had written, he told me very politely that it was garbage," end quote. And just that whole ethos that someone can be doing you a favor by telling you that your ideas are bad is like at the core of rationality. Because of, like, seeking out the best ideas rather than trying to protect your current beliefs and plans. And I just, in that respect, I would say you are more rational than Oliver Habrica and the moderators of LessWrong.com, who just banned one of their sharpest commenters, not even for politely telling people that their ideas are garbage, but just asking questions in a way that Habrica says that he, quote, "cannot help but read in a sneering voice, dripping with judgment, pointing a finger at me or the author in a way that summons judgment and punishment," end quote.
Who did he ban?
Saeed Akhmiz.
Did he also ban Tag?
No.
Oh, weird.
So from your acknowledgments page, it seems like you at least have the concept that when someone tells you your book proposal is bad, it's not summoning judgment and punishment. They just mean it's a bad book idea and you should maybe write a different book. And the sanity and maturity to recognize that is, you know, apparently a large amount of rationality in today's world. And I think the thing that Michael was trying to do in 2009 was like to create more sane and rational people, you know, like rather than the doomsday cult it turned into, separately from the fact that doomsday is still real, you know, sane, mature people would be helpful for confronting the impending doom. And so, like, the reason I put in so much effort to, like, you know, talking with you, you know, multiple times, sending you that 2,000-word email is because, like, I'm worried I'm worried you're going to tell the story of this book as like strictly the sociological lens of like, you know, here are these weird people forming a doomsday cult and they're like pulling the strings in Silicon Valley. And like, that part is true. They're like the sociological lens is valid, but there's also this other part of the story that like, the reason Yudkowsky succeeded, as I said in the email, the reason Yudkowsky succeeded and Kurzweil didn't is because like there, before we gave up on objectivity, like the rest of the world, except for Michael.
You're saying that Yudkowsky did.
Everyone gave up. There was this core insight about like how to think better, and like. I mean,
you're right. We're closer than it might seem. I want to think better. I want the world to think better. I believe in the truth.
Yeah.
I believe in objectivity.
Well, so, but.
But this is a weird thing. Whenever someone asks me whether I'm a rationalist, it just seems like an extremely wrong question, because it's like.
Yeah.
It's like you know, the thing of wanting to be right about things is like it's not restricted to like a specific community.
Yeah,
everybody should want to be right.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody should want to be rational.
Right.
And so like
children are.
And so that's why like I don't know. So because again like so I mentioned in our August 12th meeting like you know I got. You know, people who had been supportive of my work were critical of me for the fact of talking with you, because you know, in the Craft in the Community sequence, Yudkowsky had written about why our kind can't cooperate, and like the complaint was like, why can't you know, talking to the guy who docs Slate Star Codex is copper button for why our kind can't cooperate, and it's just I don't believe in that kind of cooperation anymore. Like, I'm not... So, I'm trying to... In talking to you, I have this, like, complicated, like, multidimensional objective where, on the one hand, I don't want you to slander my friends, but it's not because... I hope it's not because I'm just, like, bullshitting to cover up their reputation because I think these people are terrible. It's because, like... If like they deserve criticism, but they deserve criticism for the right reasons. And I was disappointed with the Lighthaven piece on August 4th or whatever, because the whole like, oh, this is a religion angle was like not like, as I've said, like there is an analogy, but there's like so much more.
Yeah, I think we're closer than you think. And
I hope that actually shows up in the book, because it sure as hell hasn't been showing up in your New York Times articles.
The book is different.
I hope it's different.
Well, I guess, believe me, your point is a very good one. Why did it become a doomsday cult? Why is there, like, this is the thing that I really appreciate and admire all of you actually talking to me, because... A day doesn't go by where I don't see a comment or something. I get an email.
Oh,
or somebody
that
says, you know, I'm not talking to you. That is cult-like behavior, right?
Oh, also,
no, it's not. Okay. That is behavior in response to open oppression. Open, like, social violence of precisely the sort that the people who do it also spend all their time educating the public about.
Tell me what you mean.
Like, the people who talk about stochastic violence are the people committing all the stochastic violence. The people who talk about structural racism are the people committing all the structural racism. They're the experts. That's why they're qualified to talk about it. You know, white fragility is an extremely clear explanation of how you ought to mistreat black people in order to get promoted in a structurally racist organization. And the organizations that hire Robin D'Angelo are saying, we are structurally racist. Here you are as a consultant on structural racism to inform our people. And this is text. This is not subtext. So, the thing I just said is easy for an AI to understand. It's also easy for a human to understand if they are not elite.
You know, it's about, like, this modus poens is easy. It is prerequisite for understanding as such, and is therefore easy for people to understand if they are not privileged. That, you know, if they're not being taken care of for withholding understanding as such. So, like...
Well, let me go back to my original. Why did it become a doomsday cult?
No! You don't get to do that!
Well, sir, I mean, he's using my words.
I'm just using his word. You know, he makes a good point. It became one, but really, it missed the point.
But also the thing I'm terrified of, because you've totally been doing this in your New York Times articles, and I'm hoping that I'm not an idiot for continuing to talk to you, because I'm hoping the book will be different. There's this important part where, like, doomsday is still real. the basic obvious to a child case of AI risk. Like, I still believe in that part.
Look, you reveal that you know why it's a doomsday cult through the things you say, and that the actual answer you know is unspeakable, is taboo. So only putting a false answer in other people's mouths could give you a publishable piece. You know, if you didn't know why people end up in doomsday cults, you wouldn't have ended up in the type of cult you ended up in.
My cult is what, the New York Times?
Well, the establishment, more broadly. I mean, the Times is just, you know, but like, the thing that I'm saying is, structurally, in order for anyone to be informed about anything, one needs a picture of what someone is, what it is to be anyone. And, like, in the natural commonsensical understanding of what it is to be anyone, it's very confusing what cults even are. And in the perspective from inside of some sort of a cult, it's very confusing what not cults even are. So, any true answer, any even slightly useful answer to why anyone is in a cult has to be an answer to what it looks like, what the world looks like, what it is to be in a cult. Interpretable from not in a cult. Or an answer to what it is to not be in a cult, interpretable from in a cult. And, like, rather than cult, we could use words like high-context window or low-context window, or predictive processing model versus thinking model. We can use fairly good analogies from the machines that we've got now that can describe the nature of the states, which is a separate question from describing the process of transitioning between them.
I'm
going
to have to go here pretty soon, but... Let me ask you again, like, why do you think it became, as you called it, a doomsday cult?
I mean, I might, again, there's a lot of qualifiers there, but I think from the full context of our many hours of conversation, you understand the qualifiers. Just like...
But wait, the whole point of his agenda is to discard them all anyway, and you know that.
Yeah...
And, like, the critical point is that that is straightforwardly lying from the normal objectivity perspective, but it's not straightforwardly lying from the perspective you're coming from.
Yeah, well,
and so the question becomes, what the hell fucking would constitute lying from the perspective you're coming from?
Well,
if
but
the thing that you do every single time you write anything isn't a lie.
Michael, I guess the interesting question is, like, when he says the book will be different, why am I acting as if I believe him?
Right, that is an interesting question, and it has something to do with not knowing how to act as if you disbelieve him in the proper way.
Yeah, because I have this faith. I have, like, I'm going to use the word faith. I think it's the right word. I have this faith in speech. Faith that, like, if I honestly try to describe the world as I see it, then maybe someone somewhere will be able to incorporate that information into their map and use that map to make good, to steer the world and make good things happen. And so I just can't. I'm doing the Quokka policy because I don't know what else I can do.
But you also know that it's not going to be a book solely from your point of view.
Yeah, I know that.
Spent years,
but that has nothing to do with anything. This is just another straw man. Like the standard toolkit you use for dismissing calls for objectivity is to equate objectivity with blind idiot faith of types that no one generates authentically and that you could never learn to tie your shoelaces if you were acting from them.
Yeah, so like I the like yeah, like I understand that the book is not going to be a puff piece. I understand that you're interviewing and talking to lots of people, but like there's still like I don't think I'm asking for a puff piece. Like, my faith in discourse is not that you're going to write the book from my perspective, obviously that's crazy, but that you can at least, to the extent that I am in a character in the book, you can, like, at least not lie about what my perspective is.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right.
Well,
but you don't do that as a journalist in your day-to-day article. We know that. Oh, have you heard of the Fort Bragg conspiracy? It's a book, also by a New York Times journalist, about a very high rate of murder, suicide, and other offenses by special forces. It's interesting, not because it's fun to read or the topic is important, but because it is journalism in the objectivity sense. The journalist's attitude is that they are investigating crimes, and that in order to investigate crimes, they must make sense of motives, not sociological motives, but motives from a perspective that assumes rational action by the participants. I can see that in the case of politically charged investigations of the military by the somewhat more far left of the slightly center, it is still possible to invoke the idea of projecting upon people rational type motivations and deception and concealment and interpreting. The fundamental challenge that we failed at in a rationalist movement is preserving a context of ability to do that for purposes that are not purely political.
Honestly, I appreciate all of you doing this as usual. I mean,
oh, well,
go ahead.
I did have one more question here. So, like, you on September 2nd, you emailed me saying you were doing a profile on Yudkowsky for the Times and asking if I could help fact check. And then, like, they gave the story to Kevin Roos. Do you know what happened there?
Nope.
All right. Well, because I had a theory that, like, Yudkowsky was willing to talk to him and not willing to talk to you, and so that's why they gave the story to him. All right.
I'm glad you asked.
I was just curious.
Yeah. Maybe one day we'll have it. Thank you. I'll keep you updated on how this...
Yeah, do we know when the book is coming out?
Yeah, it's probably tomorrow. And,
I mean, I'm not optimistic, but, like, I don't think I'll regret my faith in speech.
Like,
I don't think it's going to be a good book, but, like, it's not my fault.
There you go.
That's a great